Hey everybody, Kevin Rose here. Welcome back to another episode of The Kevin Rose Show. This episode is focused entirely to biohacking. And our guest today was actually on my newsletter here a couple months back. I had linked to a post that was titled, I'm 32 and spent $200K on biohacking. Became calmer, thinner, extroverted, happier, and healthier. The author's name was Serge Faguet. And I didn't know this at the time, but Serge and I shared a mutual friend, our kind of longevity doctor friend, Dr. Peter Attia. And Peter reached out to me and was like, hey, Serge saw that you had featured him in your newsletter. He'd love to connect with you. He's going to be out in San Francisco. And so I connected up and went and had a coffee with Serge, and we immediately hit it off. He is a technology geek. So he had built a couple of really successful technology companies. One, he had the largest online travel company in Russia. He also created a company called TalkBox, which is one of the largest video chat platform companies, and just a really fascinating background. He's currently working on a startup called Mirror, which is a company that uses AI to turn selfies into kind of these highly personalized emojis. And that's backed by some really powerful folks like Peter Thiel and SoftBank and a bunch of other well-known VCs. Great background. He studied at Cornell. He's worked at Google. He was the youngest in his class at Stanford Business School. So a really fascinating guy, and he is really into biohacking, and that's kind of been his passion lately. So he recently came out with another post that even was more popular than the first one that I just read, and it was titled, How to Biohack Your Intelligence with Everything from Sex to Modafinil to MDMA. And that one, now that I'm looking at it, scroll down here, it had something like, almost 20,000 claps on Medium. So he's got these really popular posts, and they're really these long, full-length, you know, it's probably going to take you 45 minutes to read through one of these posts and all the different little self-experiments that he's done. Now, I will say some of the stuff that we talk about today, well, I should say this, all the stuff that we talk about today is extremely dangerous. And when we talk about biohacking, we always talk about it in the context of working with your doctor and explaining upfront what we are planning on trying and making sure there's no interactions with certain compounds. And this is the approach that I always take. I have, Peter Attia is my kind of designated doctor for this stuff. I don't go as hardcore as Serge does. He's really all in on this to try and find these little tweaks that he can do to improve things. But I always find it fascinating. Some of the other stuff around sex and relationships, and we talk about all kinds of crazy adventures that he's had on that front. I'm not endorsing any of this stuff, but I can appreciate someone that is being completely transparent. So the one thing I really love about Serge is that he doesn't hold anything back. If he has something that he's tried in terms of the way he approaches relationships or sex, like he is just like, this throws it straight out there. And so for better or worse, he puts everything out there. And I can appreciate that because then you truly have nothing to hide. So before we get started, I want to tell you about our sponsor, and that is Audible. And that should probably come as no surprise to all of you if you've been following my podcast for the years, because I think Audible's been sponsoring my podcast for probably, 8, maybe 10 years now. And the reason I love Audible is it's my little quick hack to get more information into your brain faster. There's so many books out there that get recommended. You know, Tim Ferriss will recommend me a book, or I'll have some other founder that I really respect that recommends a book. And so I keep that little notes app on your iPhone. I write down all these books that I want to eventually read. Problem is, you just never get around to it. I just, you know, I have a new baby and it's really difficult. So anyway, I use Audible because if I'm walking between meetings, if I'm in an Uber, if I'm doing anything where there's a little bit of downtime and I have some time to kill and I want to use it in a productive way, I'll use Audible. And that's how I get through a lot of the books that I want to eventually get to. I set it to like 1.25 speed so I can consume it a little bit faster. And today I wanted to talk about a book that I just recently listened to, and you'll hear it mentioned. Actually, Serge, my guest for today, is the one that mentions it to me in this episode. So it's called Lying by Sam Harris. And it's a really cool book that talks about why we shouldn't lie, not even white lies. to our friends and how to kind of rephrase things and how it just makes for real, honest, direct communication. So, you know, if someone walks up to you and says, how are you doing today? And you say, oh, I'm doing great, thanks. And, but really there's something that's bothering you. Like there's something that's always bugged me about that, those little tiny white lies and little small talk that we do. And so anyway, this is a fun book and it's a really quick read. I think it's like an hour and 45 minutes. And you can get it when you sign up for your Audible subscription, one free audiobook. If you head on over to audible.com/Kevin Rose, you'll get your free book and a 30-day free trial. Now, you can also text Kevin Rose with no spaces to 500-500. And if you do that, you'll get a link to sign up, get that free audiobook and that 30-day free trial. So that's audible.com/Kevin Rose or text Kevin Rose to 500-500. And the book is called Lying, L-Y-I-N-G, by Sam Harris. Give it a listen. Respond back to me on Twitter and let me know what you think. And I plan to mention just books that I'm reading like every episode now going forward and kind of get you into some of these cool books that I'm finding and that other entrepreneurs are recommending to me. So I hope you enjoy that. audible.com/Kevin Rose. Now let's jump into our guest. This is Serge Fugette. Cool. So I want to start off at the very beginning, how you got involved in biohacking. What was it? Because I mean, you've been a very successful entrepreneur, primarily in Russia, right? That's where the majority of your startups have been.
Well, one of my companies has been in Russia, one in Silicon Valley, and then a new one that's kind of globally distributed.
Yeah, that's the like best way to do new companies. I feel like you can pull talent from all over the world.
Oh, totally. And I love the fact that I'm raising money at crazy high Silicon Valley valuations and spending it all over the world without the crazy high Silicon Valley cost.
Yeah, that's great. Now, when did you get into the, because you're more of an internet entrepreneur, and then what was the bridge to say, I want to get into biohacking and into kind of investing in myself?
Brief backstory. I grew up, I was born in Siberia in this academic city. My whole family were engineers and scientists. And our house was just very full of a lot of books, including books on science and science fiction. And I just loved the idea that humanity is going to explore the universe and understand how everything works, etc. And so my first interest in biotech to augment humans was more like, hey, whoa, we're going to have to live forever for that, right? To make sure that we can explore the universe and that I get to see other planets, other stars, the galaxy, all of that stuff. And that idea just stuck with me for a long time. So it was just a theoretical interest of, hey, someday I want to upgrade my body.
So this was as a kid? Was this like 12 years old? Like,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, basically. So it was all theoretical.
Mm-hmm.
And then,
especially at 12, it's
yeah.
Really,
totally.
How deep can you go at that point?
Exactly. But I think what experiences you have as a kid kind of make you passionate for things
oh,
as
absolutely.
An adult.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. And then later, when I was already running a company that had hundreds of people working there, I just started thinking, hey, you know, everything that I do, from my social relationships to my ability to be a good CEO to everything else, is really based on my body and mind. Mm-hmm. And so that's got to be the system that you want to invest in the most, mm-hmm. because that's kind of your platform, the thing that everything else is based on.
Yeah.
You invest in that, you improve everything at once.
Yeah, it's across the board,
yeah.
Both internally and externally to other people as well.
And then it was really like a couple of small, early, quick wins when, you know, I started sleeping more. And I noticed that I would procrastinate less.
What age was this?
This was probably the age of 25.
Okay.
Plus, another thing that really pointed out the power of kind of biochemistry to me is when I started taking Adderall, which really improved my life in terms of my ability to concentrate and get things done.
So let's pause there. I want to like dissect every single little hack that you've gone through, and we might be here for like a few days, but I'm curious, like, so you, at 25, you were doing startups at that
yeah.
time and you weren't sleeping well. Were you doing more of the kind of like, you know, burning the candle at both ends, like really crazy long startup hours, like pizza and beer thing? Like what was your lifestyle like back then?
kind of that. It was just not self-aware, you know? So I wasn't aware of the fact that my sleep habits were generating procrastination during the day. I wasn't aware of the fact that my food habits and the fact that I was overweight, I was 27% body fat. Now I'm like, I don't know, 9% body fat. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't just aware of the fact that that metabolic stuff made sure that I had less energy, that I was procrastinating more. And frankly, I was I was not happy. So I was not happy. I had, there were times I had like suicidal thoughts. I mean, fortunately, I've never kind of gone down that path in any way, but it was like not that great.
And yeah.
Yeah.
That's some serious stuff to deal with, and especially at that age. So Adderall was your first kind of like, I need to focus my brain. Like, how did you hear about that compound? Like, or that drug? Like, what was it?
So Adderall, it was just in university. I tried it, and it was a funny experience when I needed to write a lot of business school essays. And I went to the library, took this stuff, and half an hour later, I was like, okay, this isn't actually working. Stupid placebo, you know. And then I, you know, just work like crazy for like 6 hours, and then someone tries calling me. And I just see this and I say, okay, I'm not going to pick that up because it's going to distract me. And that's not usually how I would react to phone calls.
Right.
And then I worked for, I think, a total of about 14 hours, ran out of work, went home, and started sorting my socks by color.
Wow.
So
it hit you hard. Like,
yeah.
You're a definite responder to that compound.
I was essentially like, wow, so this biochemical thing completely changes my personality and behavior and the way I feel. And that was just an indicator of that there's something in this.
Now, Adderall is typically used for ADHD, is that right?
Yeah, that's
okay.
Correct.
So were you ever diagnosed with ADHD? Or
I was, but I made an effort to be. So, you know, there's a lot of actually guides online. Hey, how do you make sure you get Adderall prescriptions? That kind of stuff.
So you went and saw your doctor and basically got the...
And then it really, really helped. And that was just a signal to me that later over the years, I went back to and said, I wonder what else is there, like sleeping better or like taking Adderall, that could help me get more out of life. And I just started doing a lot of things, especially over the last 3-4 years, that kind of fall into a bunch of categories. Sleeping extremely well, eating extremely well, exercising the right way, taking care of your mental health, doing a lot of testing, and doing a lot of supplementation.
Where did you begin, by the way? What was it for you that where you're like, okay, sleep is number one? Like, obviously tackling all these at the same time is you're going to muddy up the data a little bit, right? So what was the first thing where you're like, okay, I want to optimize brain first? Like, how did you decide what to pursue first?
My big objective was to improve my ability, really intelligence. So I kind of define intelligence as the ability to achieve complex goals, which comes down to not just IQ, but also to your ability to focus and do deep work, which is incredibly important. Mm-hmm. Your ability to persuade other people, so social intelligence, emotional intelligence, and your ability to learn. So learning is a skill. And all of these things, including social intelligence, are actually very much determined on your biochemical state. So if you have higher testosterone, you kind of take the kind of body language that other people find persuasive. And it happens so unnoticeably that, you know, we all react to it and we all pay more attention to people who exhibit certain behaviors, and those behaviors are biochemical. That's just an example. So my objective was really to be smarter. And what I meant by that is make it easier for me to achieve my goals.
And so was that kind of, I would say that the way that I was connected to you initially is you had this really famous blog post that said, you give me the title because I'm going to mess it up.
So the first blog was, I spent $200,000 on biohacking and became healthier, happier, thinner, and smarter and more productive.
Right.
And then I just wrote another huge blog post, which was like, how to biohack your intelligence with everything from modafinil to MDMA to sex. So, and that's actually become even more popular.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, let's start diving into your experiments then. I'd be really curious to know which ones were successful, which ones didn't work, and how you tried to walk me through it.
I started, and I think everyone should start from the basics, which is really sleep, food, and exercise, and mental health. Mm-hmm. So before you get into, you know, drugs and tests, you really want to take care of the basics. And the short of it is that for sleep, which sleep is much more important than people think. What it does is it repairs every system in the body and recharges it and makes sure that it works well. So sleep is actually a very active state when your brain is working on repairing everything and optimizing everything. Mm-hmm. What I do with sleep is ultimately I try to make sure I sleep at least 8 hours a day of real sleep. And that means you have to spend close to 9 hours a day in bed. And I make sure that I sleep at the same time every day. And the reason for this is that if you cut your sleep by 2 hours, or if you shift it by 2 hours, people think, oh, okay, that makes my sleep 10% worse or 20% worse. Actually, so sleep has a lot of stages, and each of those stages performs a separate function. And for example, if you sleep less and you sleep only 6 hours, then the last stages of your sleep get destroyed completely or close to completely. So part of the function, you destroy by like 80% or so.
So your body's expecting to go into that state.
Yes.
And it doesn't ever get there.
Yes. And if you shift your sleep time by a couple hours every day, you're living in kind of a permanent state of jet lag. Mm-hmm. And the way sleep is controlled is you have two different functions. You have the circadian rhythm, and that's to do with melatonin, the sun, etc. And then you have what's called sleep pressure, a chemical called adenosine, which accumulates in your brain as you are awake. And if those things are synchronized together, then you sleep well. If they're not, let's say I go to sleep today 3 hours later than yesterday, I'm actually going to miss on the early parts of sleep, the deep, slow wave sleep that actually really repairs your brain and does things like prevent Alzheimer's.
Why would you miss that though? Why wouldn't that just start a little bit later?
Because your circadian rhythm has you going to sleep at, let's say, 10 p.m. And if you and your adenosine is having you to go to sleep at like 1 a.m. or you go to sleep at 1 a.m. because you drank a bunch of coffee, then you're kind of mismatched. You're out of sync with your circadian rhythm and your body just gets deep sleep that is worse. So, you know, we both use this product called the Oura Ring, which I think is a wonderful device that that really helps people get a good tracking of their sleep data. I see pretty clearly that when I sleep at the same time, my deep sleep improves. And from their data, it seems that deep sleep is the number one problem that people have.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Mine is always pegged at like 10% out of 100% goal, and it's brutal. And sometimes I can get that up to like 20%, and I've never been able to figure out how to really fully maximize that. Maybe it is my timing of my sleep, because I tend to be all over the place. Mm. Some days I go to bed at, you know, 10:30, other times at midnight. Like it really varies. So how does one figure out their optimal timing for sleep? Like how do you figure out when the circadian rhythms and when the
I think it's important to use some device to track.
So you've tried experiment. Like, okay, I'm going to go to bed at 8:30 versus 9:30 versus 10:30, and then look.
Tried a little bit, and I just found that I really like waking up early. So I really just enjoy it, both in a physical and an emotional sense, to wake up with the dawn at like 6 a.m. And then you work backwards from that. If you want to wake up at 6 a.m. and you know that you need to get 8 hours of sleep, and even with high sleep efficiency, so the percent of time you spend asleep, that requires at least 8.5 to 9 hours, you have to go to sleep at 9:30 in the evening. And then you do that consistently and you work backwards with other things. So I start wearing my orange blue light blocking glasses like 4 or 5 hours before I go to sleep. I stop drinking coffee about 9 hours before I go to sleep.
Yeah, you had me rush and make you a cup of coffee real quick so you could get that last little. Did you? Oh, you didn't finish it.
I didn't finish quite yet, but yeah.
Do you still have time?
I still have probably about 20 minutes.
All right, so you can feel free to like chug it in between sentences.
Yeah. So actually, it's interesting because coffee, people think that, oh, if I don't drink it for 3 hours before sleep, it's okay. But actually, caffeine, you know, even for fast coffee metabolizers, coffee metabolism is a genetic thing. Mm-hmm. Even for fast metabolizers, it takes, the half-life is like 5-6 hours. And that means that if I stop drinking 9 hours in advance, I'm still going to have a quarter of that caffeine in my body.
I have this issue with, and so does my wife, and that we'll have a cup of coffee. And even if I have it like at, you know, 8:39 a.m., I'm still not going to sleep as well as if I had switched to tea or something else or
none at all. So people with slow caffeine metabolism, and that's about half the population, I think a lot of the clinical data suggests that you shouldn't drink coffee at all.
And I believe my 23andMe genetic test will tell you how fast of a metabolizer you are. That's right.
That's right. So in terms of sleep, I really would just focus on those things. There's other stuff like, hey, don't exercise or don't eat too much close to sleep. And you know, it helps to exercise well and to eat well and to take care of your mental health. But those are the main things that you want to do. And sleep, the reason it's so key is that a lot of this stuff, it requires discipline. Mm-hmm. And without sleep, at least I find that I start procrastinating, my willpower drops, etc. So sleep is a very important cornerstone.
The one thing I want to bring up that you had mentioned to me one time that I thought was fascinating is you said that sometimes you would wake up in the middle of the night and you have a pretty interesting hack for how to get back into deep sleep taking the cold shower in the middle of the night.
It's really fascinating because I find that cold showers, like as cold as possible, they really switch me off. And
is that just like an N of one and this is just you, or is there data to back this up? Like, how did you come up with this hack?
I read about it somewhere. I think Tim Ferriss actually said that he tried cold showers before sleep. And I was like, okay, there's no way that's going to work. But I tried, and it actually really helps put me to sleep. And I've tried a bunch of times when I would wake up at night, especially after shifting a lot of time zones. Then if I wake up in the middle of the night, I go and take a cold shower, get back, and it helps fall asleep. Hmm. Really weird.
Yeah, the one of our mutual friends, and I think both of our kind of doctors, Peter Attia, had mentioned to me that there are these mattresses that you can get that will put cold like air through them to help you get into a deeper
cold water. They're called chili pads.
Yeah, have you tried that?
Yeah, I really like it. So they're kind of big and bulky, and I travel all over the world all the time and live in hotels, so I cannot really bring it with me. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so those are really cool.
Awesome. So
literally. Okay.
Yeah. So sleep, sounds like you've got that one dialed in. What's next?
So food. In terms of nutrition, I mean, there's a lot of opinions all over the place, but the fundamentals are fairly well agreed on. And it's, don't eat processed crap, especially sugar, because sugar, and here's just one example, sugar feeds cancer cells preferentially, or rather cancer cells can subsist on sugar because it's fairly easy to break down and fast, whereas normal cells can use ketones. It's called the Warburg effect, although I'm probably mangling the explanation. And so there's a lot of data suggesting that by eating low sugar diets, you're helping your body protect against cancer.
Yeah, and there's a whole slew of things that sugar kicks off in terms of inflammation and higher glucose levels and all that bad stuff.
A lot of stuff. So what I do in terms of nutrition is mostly cut out sugar and just processed crap.
That's like 90% of what people need to do.
Yeah, it's a really large part of it. I mean, and then there's some people who subscribe to the keto diet in the sense of I'm going to eat infinite bacon and it's healthy. I'm a bit more conservative on that. I do eat bacon and high quality meat occasionally, but I mostly try to eat nuts and avocado and kind of olive oil. So
yeah,
healthy fats.
Well, and plus those have been battle tested. I mean, if you take a look at centenarians, I mean, they have all been consuming this stuff, and we actually have real data in terms of like they are living right. longer versus like I have yet to meet a centenarian that is just like I've been all bacon for the last 50 years.
Right. And then the other thing I do is intermittent fasting. So most days I eat only once a day in the time block between 2 p.m. and 6 p.m.
Oh, wow. So just once a day. Okay.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That puts you at about like, wow, that's kind of crazy.
Actually, I find that it's really, really useful in a number of ways. First of all, you don't get distracted because eating is context switching. And so when we get to talking about intelligence, a lot of my framework is around getting a lot of hours of deep, concentrated work every day. And so eating just distracts from that.
That's what's funny is like you and I differ here a little bit. And I love it because you tend to be, and we've hung out just a handful of times, so like, correct me if you think I'm wrong here, but like, you seem to see like you really appreciate the focus of just like having like this like very driven day. Whereas I would say that I want to make sure to have enjoyable moments of eating because I think that there's some benefit to that as well, like taking the time to enjoy the food and savor it. And my wife will tell you that I don't do that because I scarf down, but I subscribe to that idea.
I'd say that I subscribe to that idea as well. What I want to get to on a daily basis is 5, 6, 7 hours of truly deep work. During which I can do things that are creative. I can study. I can learn to improve my social skills. I can do all kinds of cool stuff. And then I'm going to have the rest of the day free. And if I'm super focused, those 7, 8 hours, I do I'm enormously productive. And I get that every day pretty much, unless I get sick, which is occasionally happens. I get that 7, 8 hours of real flow on a daily basis.
Gotcha.
And then after that, I feel much more relaxed about enjoying food, about going to a spa, about going and hanging out with my friends.
Do you drink at all?
I stopped. As we'll talk about, there's a couple reasons why I stopped. One is it's actually disruptive to my sleep. So I noticeably see that even half a glass of wine just disrupts my deep sleep especially.
Wow.
I recently read an awesome book, which I highly recommend to everyone about sleep. It's called Why We Sleep. It's I don't remember the name of the author. He's the head of the sleep lab at Berkeley. And it's a wonderful book that goes into a lot of detail about this. And he says that alcohol is actually the most powerful suppressant of deep and REM sleep there is.
Man, you're killing me. This will explain why my deep sleep's so low. I like to have a glass of wine or two at dinner.
So, well, there you go. You have an opportunity to improve.
I love just like, there's something nice about that. And I, granted, I go like these last 3 months, I've done fasting for 5 days per month. So I've had 15 completely like free days of no alcohol, which has been great. But I would say that more oftentimes than not, like having a glass of wine with dinner is awesome.
I just stopped and I don't really feel like I've lost much, especially since, and we'll get to this later, I just think there's much better ways to get high than alcohol that are both less dangerous and more useful. But we'll get to that.
Yeah, I'm excited to stay tuned for some craziness because we talked about this before the podcast started. Search was like, hey, do you mind if I bring up some special substances? And I was like, yeah, go for it, dude. Like, this is just one, we're not recommending anything. This is just one man's adventure. So,
exactly.
Which I love
so
it.
Stay tuned. A lot of drugs and sex coming up. So back to food. I guess we talked about pretty much everything.
Yeah. Okay. So that sounds like a pretty awesome diet. I love it. Unprocessed being the absolute key. We've got the food cover. We have sleep cover. What was your third pillar?
The third one is exercise. Mm-hmm. And really, I subscribe to a very simple approach, which Peter Attia helped me develop, which I'm really thankful to him. Peter is awesome.
He is awesome.
So it's basically Do hip hinge exercises, which are deadlifts, squats, leg presses, mm-hmm. a couple times a week in the gym. So I go to the gym, I do a warm up, and the kind of warm up I do, actually, Peter describes on his blog. I think it's called How You Move Defines How You Live. Mm-hmm. So I do a warm up that takes about 15 minutes. Then I do a whole hour of hip hinge exercises. So like 12 sets of deadlifts. Mm-hmm. And then I do a bit of work on other major muscle groups like chest and back.
Now, we should mention that this isn't just like, if you're listening to this, you're like, okay, you're just describing your workout routine, but there is purpose behind
exactly.
This.
So this is important. A lot of people you see in the gym spending time pumping their biceps, for example, because they like it to be sculpted. But if you think about it, the bicep compared to your glutes and quads and hamstrings is a tiny muscle. It's a tiny muscle. And so when you exercise stuff with a squat, the number of muscle cells that you activate with one rep is far, far greater, and your metabolism supplies them with nutrients, and you're kind of like getting a much stronger metabolic effect mm-hmm. in your entire body by just doing that. And I had the conversation with Peter about this. He basically said, hey, you know, ultimately, if you just do the deadlifts and you do them really well for the rest of your life, that's going to give you much more value than doing like 10 upper body exercises.
Yeah, so explain the value. Where does the value, because people would say, okay, all we've talked about so far is the value is just like doing the exercise, but where does it come from? Is it sensitizing your body to glucose? Like, what is it?
It's a number of things. So it's producing hormones. So there's a lot of evidence that it produces a favorable improvement to testosterone and things like that.
And this is good for longevity purposes for your mind?
Yeah. So we'll talk about specifically testosterone. I mean, it really helps, at least for men. I'm actually not sure what the hormonal system for women is in terms of what's optimal. But for men, it certainly helps your mood, your energy levels, your, you know, sex drive. So yeah, so exercise helps that. Exercise helps create more muscle cells. And that means that your body is more metabolically active and removes glucose from your bloodstream faster and more effectively, which leads to lower insulin resistance and a host of other benefits.
So when you sensitize your muscles to pull glucose out, and correct me if I'm wrong here, because I'm still trying to wrap my head around all this stuff. Essentially, what you're doing then is releasing less insulin, because the body's making use of it through the muscles.
Essentially. And again, I'm not a biochemist, and I'm not a scientist in nutrition, so I might be mangling a lot of this. So
you spend, the reason I wanted to have you on the show is you spend a ton of time researching and with these people to understand this stuff.
So my understanding is that it pulls out glucose from the bloodstream. That means that the body has less glucose to dispose of.
Right.
That means it requires less insulin, and it packs less glucose into fat cells. Mm-hmm. And that has a host of beneficial effects. So one of the key things that, again, we work with Peter is really improving your body's glucose disposal and improving insulin resistance.
That's right. So. And so, yeah, that's something I've been working on with Peter as well. And we do like a yearly glucose tolerance test. And so for people that don't know what that is, someone comes over to your house, you sit down, or you can do it in a lab, and they draw your blood. So you've been fasting, they draw your blood, they check your glucose levels. So, you know, you want to have that in the healthy range, which is like 70s or 80s, I guess. By the way, what is your fasting glucose?
So my fasting glucose is probably 80, but I think, which isn't that amazing, but what happens when I do the glucose tolerance test is I drink that tube.
Yeah, they make you drink a 100% glucose drink.
It's, so it's like 75 sugar. Grams like of really, really refined sugar. So my glucose only rises from 80 to like 90 or 95.
Which is insane. For people that don't know, I go to basically like 230. Like,
and then what's even cooler is that with only a small amount of insulin, like insulin of, I don't remember, I think 30, with that, my glucose after 2 hours goes down to about 45.
That's low.
That is very low. And the reason that happens is that my body is so unused to a tube of sugar that even that little amount of insulin, and my body is so insulin sensitive.
Do you get
that
shaky?
No, I don't actually.
You're so lucky. I
did not notice that, even though, you know, 45 is where you're supposed to start getting hypoglycemic.
Oh my God, I felt that feeling and it is not fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, so mine is basically, and people, you should talk to your doctor about trying this out because it's really good to it detects a handful of different things. It'll kind of tell you if you're pre-diabetic. Like, there's a bunch of stuff that you can get out of this that is positive, and you can go into your doctor's office and have it performed. And typically, most insurance stuff will cover this. But the thing we didn't mention is that you get that initial blood draw, you drink that drink, and then at 1 hour and 2 hours, they do additional blood draws. So you're getting stuck three times, and then they pull out the blood and put it in a tube, and then they go and test it for both glucose and insulin levels. So they can figure out how much insulin your body's releasing in response to this and how well you respond to it and how quickly it drops. So my first test was not good. I didn't go too high, and I had good baseline glucose, but I had a problem disposing of it. And so Peter had since then, and Peter's our, if you haven't heard of Peter, I'm going to have him on the podcast at some point, and you can look him up on Tim Ferriss's podcast. He's like a longevity doctor and a true, really deep biohacker. And so he got me on doing a lot more cardiovascular related stuff. I have my Peloton bike and I do a lot more heavier leg work there as well. And testing it 1 year later, I've improved on my disposal quite a bit. So we're pretty happy with the progress there. But anyway, so continue on.
The other stuff I do on exercise is just high intensity interval training a couple of times a week, which is, from everything I've seen, much more effective of a way to do cardio than just, you know, running for a whole hour. The reason for that, so what it is you let's say warm up for 5 minutes, and then you run like crazy, like as fast as you possibly can for 20 seconds. Then you rest for like a minute to a minute and a half, and then you repeat that cycle about 8 times. In doing that, you really push your body to the limit and help your cardiovascular system develop, help your mitochondria grow, and it's more effective for many things than exercising for an entire hour, because you kind of keep the metabolism going even after you're done,
right,
as opposed to just when you're doing running.
Yeah, a lot of people report weight loss doing that HIIT, the high intensity interval training. The thing I was going to ask you is that it's a very hot topic right now, and there's been a lot of studies on different various like durations. So like, you know, do you do 60 seconds on, 30 seconds off, or do you do a minute and 20 seconds on? Like, I've seen so many different protocols for that. Some say they're better for creating mitochondria. Others say they're better for weight loss. Do you prescribe to any one particular one, or you just kind of just like throw your hands up and say,
I focused on the stuff that creates mitochondria.
And
but
what is that? What does that regimen look like?
I think this is all very speculative.
Yeah.
I've heard some people say that that would be where you give yourself a little bit more time to rest. So not like 30 seconds off, but 90 seconds off. But I have no idea. And for me,
there
this
has been studies done on this. I don't know how they would figure out mitochondria increase. Do you know?
I'm not sure. So I just decided for myself that I'm probably getting a lot of the value out of this piece already.
Sure.
And that I will spend the time better elsewhere. So it's just a question of where do you focus in your priorities.
Right. Okay, cool. So that's like your cardio. We got your, now that's kind of like the basis of like healthy things that you can do. Not to say that compounds and other things aren't healthy, but like then you get into a little bit more kind of gray area.
Yeah.
What did you start playing with?
So initially, so if we step back for a second, my objective was really intelligence. Mm-hmm. And once, you know, your body is getting enough sleep, good nutrition, good exercise, then the biggest thing, at least I was getting in my way, is really ultimately, I guess you could call it mental health or stress resilience or something of that nature. So I would have days when, for no good reason, my mood would become crap and I would just like have a bad day and not be able to work well and just not enjoy it. And that would happen, I don't know, for a couple of days a month.
Do you mean by crap? Like what is, give me a little bit more description there. Like
just a bad mood, just a bad mood,
little or cloud over your head. Just kind of like, I'm not loving today.
Exactly. And so the stuff that's helped get rid of that, and I really almost, I think I never have this now, except if I get sick or something, or just after a lot of jet lag when I'm flying over from Europe to the Bay Area. So the things that helped are meditation. And I started doing meditation years ago, but I wasn't doing it right. And I kept kind of listening initially to Headspace. Then I went to some courses on transcendental meditation. It was definitely having an effect that I would do it for, you know, like 20 minutes a day, 30 minutes a day, pretty consistently. It was pleasant. And I felt like it was starting to make me more self-aware and more relaxed. But then I found a really good coach who just helped push me to like really specific cool techniques. Like one thing that I'll mention is, so if I have a strong emotion, I can sit down and find physical manifestations of that emotion in my body, focus on them a little bit. And the emotion, even if it's really, really strong, it goes away in 30 seconds. It just vanishes. And then, you know, it's gone. It's really cool. And another thing that, you know, specific technique that I've been taught is to kind of visualize yourself from the side when you're looking at yourself. You know, so I can see myself sitting here talking with you from the side right now, not in great detail, but that helps you see yourself as a little bit external. And then you can say, hey, why is that guy so pissed off about, you know, this little minor annoyance? You know, right. he knows that minor annoyances happen every day, right? So he should let it go. And then it's easier when you don't identify with your own ego.
Sure.
So meditation was very, very helpful. And I'm not an expert in it. I'm still a student. I feel like there I'm only starting the journey. One thing that's had a massively positive impact on my social intelligence and my mental health is taking MDMA. First of all, for those who don't know what MDMA is, it's a drug, an illegal drug, that people take either in a club setting or in like a social setting. And what it does is it makes you feel, first of all, that all your social fears go away. So you feel perfectly comfortable giving people feedback or accepting feedback from other people, or, you know, hugging someone else's wife right next to them. And you basically feel like social fears completely go away for a long time, for a fairly long time. You feel very empathetic towards other people.
Yeah, this has been used before it was made illegal. It was used in therapy settings. So they would have it in the States, and you would sit down with your therapist, and it was very good at doing a lot of deep work, because when you drop these walls that you have, it just makes you so much more open.
Yeah, exactly.
And just, it's actually been used also to treat PTSD in soldiers and...
That's right. So right now, what's really cool is that the FDA is about to approve it as a legal treatment for PTSD.
Is that going to happen?
Yes. They named it a breakthrough drug. And I guess it's going to be very highly regulated for now.
Fine.
But I think that eventually it's going to get legalized, because it's a very powerful tool for becoming happier. So again, we're not recommending, you know, you take it, but I'm just describing my personal experience.
Yeah. And something that people should know as well, on top of that, is that when it's not regulated, you never know what you're getting. And so when people go to buy this type of stuff illegally, I've heard of some really bad stories. And actually, some friends of mine have had stuff that's like cut together with who knows what, you know, and you take it and you're taking like Drano cleaner and like put speed in there. And it just like, it can be a very dangerous thing on top of already the legality side, but in terms of like harming your body if it's contaminated with all kinds of stuff.
The interesting thing is, so I was recently doing a talk at the Battery. It's this, I guess, private club in San Francisco. And I asked people, so, okay, and it was an audience of maybe 200 people who are mostly, you know, tech leaders and stuff like that. And I asked them, how many people have taken MDMA? And it was more than half of the people there raised their hands. Mm-hmm. And I'm assuming some people didn't because, you know, your wife is there with you and you've never told her and you're like, I'm not going to raise my hand. But that's impressive because something that's a Schedule I drug, you know, 50% of people in a highly sophisticated audience have taken, you know?
Yeah.
So, and I would say that Americans are mostly very law-abiding people. So this is clearly a case where the law is actually undermining its own moral authority by making something illegal that shouldn't be illegal.
Yeah.
So back to the story, it also does is it completely removes that inner voice of you complaining to yourself or thinking, worrying about the future or saying, oh my God, I was on Kevin's podcast yesterday and I forgot to say something which I should have said. So replaying all those conversations, that all goes away.
How long does that, I mean, I know that there's that window of actually taking the compound and having the benefit of having all these walls dropped and, you know, that can be an 8-12 hour type thing. What happens in terms of long-term benefits?
Right. So that's the most key thing. So first of all, I think it's important to describe the setting in which I've taken it and the mental frame in which I've taken it. The setting was a house party with some close friends, some relatives, some people who I didn't know, but like a curated group of people getting together to chill, you know, Buddhist paintings, nice music, lasers on the ceiling, that kind of thing. So not a club environment. And I came into it wanting to become more extroverted and improve my people skills because mm-hmm. I was unhappy at the time with my development in that area. And I really, really wanted to be better, but I didn't know how. And in the process, when I found it so easy to connect, so easy to tell people what I really think, and I saw how people like it when you tell them what's on your mind, when you're super open, super honest, super genuine, people really, really like you in that mode. Mm-hmm. And I just basically said, hey, I actually want to behave this way all the time. And it's almost like, you know, a tennis coach took you by the arms and legs and showed you how to do the perfect swing, and you also enjoyed it. Yeah. And so after that, the next, you know, however many days, I made up with some people who I've had a falling out with before and rekindled friendships. I approached every hot girl I came across, just not even to pick them up, but more to get over my own discomfort at approaching, you know, a girl in a restaurant. And it stayed with me permanently.
Yeah.
Permanently. So I'll do it occasionally. So I do it, you know, every some number of months, but it's more to do it with new people and to enjoy it mm-hmm. rather than to, because I really need it. So really, really useful.
The one thing that scared me about it is I had heard about data around it really destroying like brain cells. Like how much of that is true? Have you looked into that?
Yeah. So I think what that is talking about is mostly people who take frequent large doses. If you look at a number of analyses of different drugs and their risks and their risk of addiction and their risks of actual damage to you or to other people, MDMA is one of the safest drugs out there and significantly safer than alcohol and tobacco. And this is actually the consensus. I haven't been able to find any studies that suggested that MDMA is less dangerous than those substances. If I remember correctly, MDMA is responsible for about 50 deaths in the United States per year, mostly in conjunction with other drugs, whereas alcohol and tobacco are responsible combined for hundreds of thousands of deaths in the United States. And the per user numbers are also very, very different. Mm-hmm. So to me, that was a powerful tool because it made me much calmer and just more relaxed and more social, etc. But it also helped me be more persuasive. So I started being really open with people. So in my posts, just for example, so in my posts, I describe, first of all of my tests are listed publicly and I don't feel any concern about the privacy of that. I list that I take illegal drugs. I list that, you know, I'm not in a relationship right now. And frankly, I often just hire Russian fashion models for sex. So I just do that. And I'm comfortable with everyone knowing about this, even though it's the kind of thing that other people would just not talk about
right.
at all. And
because your walls have come down from
my walls have come down completely.
It must feel really freeing.
It is intensely liberating.
Because everybody has these like guards up, like what can I say? What can I, you know, and not everyone's hiring Russian models, but everyone has their thing, right?
Right.
That's something that they want to guard and protect and not let people know. They may have anxiety. They may have, you know, it could be any number of things. So we all have them.
Yeah.
The skeletons that we want to hide.
Totally.
And just to let those go, it's amazing.
So here's an example. I mean, Kevin says more than 100,000 people will listen to this episode. And I used to have a huge insecurity about my height. I'm like 5'8", and I used to agonize about it. I used to like dream about like, you know, like doing some kind of medical intervention to fix that when I was, you know, a teenager, etc. And it was really making me unhappy. And now I'm so comfortable talking about it that it's like, I don't care. It's in my articles. I don't care if everybody knows about this. And so I own this stuff. It doesn't own me.
That's so awesome.
And it's super liberating. And by the way, so my articles where I talk about, you know, hiring Russian models for sex while doing drugs with them, you know, my parents read those articles and my ex-girlfriends read those articles. So it's just like,
do they accept you for that, or are they really disappointed?
I think no. So I have had very few people said that they're disappointed in any way. I mean, some people are shocked at first, but then kind of understand where I'm coming from, because I'm coming from a place of total openness. Like if I were, you know, married and in a relationship, I would just want my girlfriend or wife to just do this stuff with me. And but I would never cheat, because I feel like, you know, it's so important to have trusting relationships with other people. Mm-hmm. And when people see that you volunteer the kind of information that others never volunteer, they first of all feel like you can be trusted in a very strong, real way. And secondly, it's actually a signal of very high confidence and social status. Because if you reveal your weaknesses to the world and are still so confident that no one's going to ever use this against you, that means you have a lot of personal confidence and power. It's kind of like that power pose when you're holding hands behind your back. You know, you're so confident that you're not afraid that someone's going to attack your undefended chest.
Right.
So it's very similar. And yeah, it's very liberating.
Yeah,
I'm really enjoying this.
I think it really sharing that stuff and getting it off your chest and get it out in the open, it really is the hardest thing you can possibly do. So it has to come from a place of strength, right? Because the easiest thing to do is to keep it guarded and not share.
Absolutely.
That is like by far the easiest. That's what we all do. We just like heads down, just like, this is my little world. These are my own little struggles. That is a place of just being all about, just inner kind of focus and not really just letting go and the holding on and ruminating over things. When you let go and you release, you're actually doing the most difficult thing.
Absolutely. And it's not just about your kind of secret insecurities or secret sex habits or something like that. It's also, this is very usable in everyday conversations.
Yes.
So before I came up to your apartment, I was talking with this girl who I like, and by phone, and we didn't have, the conversation was kind of starting slow. And I just said, hey, you know, I feel like this conversation is going really slowly. I feel uncomfortable with that we're discussing the weather. Doesn't that annoy you as well? And she's like, yeah, it annoys me too. It's like that broadcasting of your own internal true emotional state. People really connect with that.
Oh, for sure.
Really connect with it.
This happened to me last night, actually. I mean, it can be really simple things too, actually. I got in the elevator and somebody was like, hey, how's it going? Or just like, they're being friendly enough, you know, like, what's up? And I was like, you know, normally I would be like, nothing much, like blah, 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 heads down, look at my phone, like wait to the elevator. I'm like, I just had the best dark chocolate and almonds. Like, have you ever like dipped chocolate into like almond butter? It's like the most amazing thing ever. But like, I was just like thinking that in my head because it was so awesome that I just had that. And it's like that type of conversation versus the standard, like, how's your day? How's the weather? All of that stuff. That was all bullshit, right? It's not even anything real. And then we just like went back and forth about dark chocolate and freaking almonds for like 30 seconds. And it was a much more like friendly thing. And now when I see that person that lives in my building, it'll be a more friendly thing. And it's just like, it opens you up a little.
Yeah. I just did over the weekend, I did this class at Stanford, which is called Tea Groups. And what it is, it's a class on emotional intelligence. They get you into a room with 10 other people who you don't know, plus a couple instructors. And then they kind of guide you in talking for a long time, up to like 6 hours a day, for a long time into talking about emotional states, talking about how you feel about the other person and why, talking about what you feel about what they said. And you start noticing that the more you open up, and people, like a lot of people cried in this thing. So I think most people cried. People revealed struggles making friends for many years, revealed like struggles with having children or struggles with having a career after having children. That kind of super private stuff. And it makes your ability to connect with people so much more powerful when you're open and when you go for the emotional content rather than, you know, I have a problem. I often ramble about science. So I start rambling about neuroscience this and neurotransmitter that, and other people get bored. Whereas when you say, hey, when you just said that, I felt so elated. You say that and then you pause. And then, you know, that's just a very powerful way to connect with people.
100%. I love that you're taking these classes too. I think that's the other part about this that we haven't even mentioned is this openness doesn't have to be directed at individuals. It can be just like the openness to say, I don't know something. And that's a big hurdle for learning. So many people are scared to say when they don't know something, and it's hurt me so many times in my career in the past where I thought like, well, I can't expose that about myself. I'm supposed to know this at this age and have this figured out. Like, I don't know how to manage this person, but I'll just try my, you know, and had I just opened up to mentors and to other people, you put yourself in a better position to really embrace lifelong learning, which is the only way you can improve yourself.
Right. And I guess like, to sum up this discussion, I feel like it's really important to show your vulnerability and your true emotional state pretty much all the time. So there will be some cases in which you'll suffer for it. If, you know, there's a toxic relationship and someone's going to take advantage of you having opened up. But, you know, you're actually better off without that relationship and it's better if it goes away. And on the balance, people will really like you the more vulnerability you show. Mm-hmm. And it's a super strong signal of social status and confidence if you do this. I also recommend reading a book by Sam Harris called Lying, in which he basically makes the case for that you should never, ever lie ever in any circumstance. And he makes a really good, compelling argument for it, not just from a moral point of view, but from a practical point of view of your day-to-day social skills and success. Mm. Highly recommended. It's
very
just like
cool.
50 pages. So it's a short book and really compelling.
Awesome. I'll definitely check that out. That sounds like something I'd enjoy. So let's get into, we talked about MDMA to kind of like do periodically, not in a party setting, not in a rave. You're actually going in with an intention.
So it's really important to treat those things not as a party drug, but as a self-development and self-improvement tool.
Yeah, I believe that going in with an intention in this stuff really helps focus the kind of outcome and the energy of that session so that you can you don't just get carried away in something, some tangent that is not related to what your initial pre taking the substance thing is. So I think focus there is good, which we can talk about high dose mushrooms, which is kind of my experience on this related stuff. Which will help. Have you done high dose mushrooms at all?
I have not. So, but I look forward to discussing.
Yeah. That. I mean, I'll tell you real quick, since it's my time to probably tell a story about this stuff. So I've actually never said this before, publicly, but I don't mind doing it because I think it's really important. So I had read about the studies that were done with cancer patients, and Tim Ferriss helped fund a lot of that stuff. And, Dave Morin, also a buddy of mine, helped fund some of it as well. And they essentially were doing this study out of New York, where they give people that have these terminal illnesses that are going to die high-dose mushrooms, so psychedelic mushrooms. And they did it in a very clinical setting, not clinical in the sense of like, meaning that they were actually, it was a real study where they were measuring the outcomes of these things, but not the actual setting was quite nice. It was like very much laying on a couch, like very relaxed, like, you know, like you said earlier, like, you know, there's some kind of objects around the room that feel very comforting to the person. They were invited to bring their own objects into that setting. And they gave them these high doses of psilocybin and essentially went on this journey where they explored like their inner feelings and thoughts. And, the outcome is that these patients were just coming out of this no longer fearing death and no longer having horrible anxiety around dying. Like, as you can imagine, like there's a lot of anxiety around the kind of end of life when your ego is not ready to let go, when you can't really surrender to the moment. And this is just an amazing thing. And they're also doing this type of research with people that have been in wars and the PTSD related stuff as well. And all the results are really compelling. So I happen to know someone in New York that was like, hey, this isn't at university, but it's the same thing. And would you like to come and try this? And I was like, you know, what the hell? Let's do it. So signed up for it. Had a couple of pre kind of coaching sessions to really prepare myself for it, put together my intentions. I arrived at the place. We wrote down on a whiteboard what my intentions were going into this. What are some of the things that I wanted to address? And for me, that was a lot of my father, who has since passed away, a lot of the anger that he had towards my mother. He was a very verbally abusive person to my mother. And I'd wanted to be able to reconcile that because he was an amazing father, but really horrible husband.
Thank you for sharing that. I think that that's a great example of something, you know, I feel empathy towards you and just closer to you just because you shared something like that, which, you know, most people would be afraid of sharing. So I think you just did a great example for the power of being vulnerable.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it just feels so good because there's nothing to be ashamed of. Like, every single one of us has one of these stories. It may not be my exact story, but we all have something like this. You know, you can't be a human and go through life without taking on some damage somewhere. You know, so essentially I sat down and I drank this little vial, and it wasn't actual mushrooms. They had distilled it down into, you know, just a liquid form. And I drank it down, and I had done mushrooms a couple times, but little tiny, tiny bits of at concerts. I was always scared of them because one time I did it and it gave me horrible anxiety, horrible. I was kind of like, because there's a state where you, if you are still attached to your body and you can't like let go, I was like, I'm trying to control this, but things are happening and I just got really antsy around it. So I was assured that by doing the high dose version, you kind of blast through that state and you lose control of that and you go into another place. So long story short, I put a mask on, I laid down, I probably sobbed for about 4 hours, worked through a lot of tough issues, saw a lot of the pressure that I know that my grandfather was a very angry person, and that I could see very clearly the transfer of negative energy to my father, which then he was then in pain himself and letting go and releasing that on my mother. And it was a very freeing thing to feel that and let that go and let it end with me and be able to release his pain. And I know this sounds really crazy, and for people that haven't experienced this stuff, it can sound at times very like woo-woo and weird and spiritual, but like just having that release is an amazing freeing thing. And I could see where these cancer patients that have gone through this were able to have that release on their side, let go and be in a much better state. So that was my therapy, very guided, two people with me all the time, walking me through it, you know, because you're going into a really deep, intense place. So this is, I guess my story is also one and the same, that around the idea that this is becoming, and I'm seeing more people that I've met that are becoming coaches in this genre. So it's not like a drug thing. And the way that I grew up with drugs and the way that we were taught drugs in like the 80s and 90s was like this, like, you know, you're going to turn into a junkie and you're going to be on the street if you touch any type of drug. This is like using these compounds to unlock and release just emotions. And it's a therapeutic thing. It's not to be put in the same genre of someone that is abusing opioids on the street or even getting involved in opioids or combining this stuff with other substances and just getting wasted every night. It's a very prescriptive based thing for a very specific outcome.
And again, so if you look at the research and that's published in Lancet and other top medical journals, they actually rate specifically psilocybin and LSD as even safer than MDMA. So if I'm not mistaken, there's basically very, very, very few people have died from things related to this. And they're also really not addictive.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I can't imagine. Once you go through that journey, you're just like, I there's no addiction. Like, I can't even imagine wanting to, like, I don't want to go back there anytime soon because it was a lot of hard work. Like, you know, it's not just like all rainbows and like pretty colors. Like, you're going to some deep places in your soul and letting stuff go. But yeah, so we're over an hour in and we're just getting started. But I don't want this to go on forever. And I do want to get to some of the stuff that you've, because your articles are amazing. Of course, I'll link those up in the show notes here inside of the podcast description. Most podcast players support that now. So you can just click on a link within the podcast description and it should open up the articles. But let's go through your regimen. Cause I mean, when I first sat down with over coffee with you, you're like, hey, here's my pills. And you put them on the table and there was probably 30 pills you take a day.
I think more. So I take, I think, 10 different prescription drugs plus 40 or so different supplements. But let's talk about kind of this together with testing.
Okay.
The objective of testing, the way I see it, is, well, and what I mean by testing is doing, you know, a couple hundred different blood markers and doing it from time to time and seeing how they change over time. There's really two objectives. One is to find if you have any problems. And, you know, I was having this conversation with Peter Attia and asked him, hey, so do any people have perfect tests across the board? And his answer was no. So that he's never seen a patient who had no issues, even if it was a very young patient, but our issues are different. So for example, I have elevated LP little a, which is a factor that has some risk in terms of atherosclerosis, or naturally elevated homocysteine, which I fix, things like that.
You have elevated homocysteine as well.
I used to. I managed to get it down and fix it.
With methylated Bs?
Methylated Bs, mostly, yeah.
Yeah, Peter tried to get me on methylated Bs, and it just gave me a little bit of anxiety when I was doing high doses of them. And I couldn't get it down, even with trying it. Interesting. I got dropped it a couple points, but it's still elevated.
So the first thing is to just test and figure out your bugs. I like calling them bugs. And since these
I love
things,
that too.
Since these things actually damage your body over time, over your entire lifetime, it's actually very, very similar to bugs in a software system. The earlier you find them, the less they're going to cost you. And then you use things like lifestyle interventions and supplements and drugs to fix those. The other thing is that certain things could be suboptimal. So for me, I had naturally somewhat lower than average levels of thyroid hormones for whatever reason. So I take synthetic thyroid hormones to elevate myself from, you know, under the average to like reasonably high but not hyperthyroid. And I've noticed a very distinct improvement in my mood, in my energy levels, etc., just from fixing that. So the key stuff, I guess, like, let's start from the...
Well, can I ask you one question real quick first?
Sure.
So in finding these bugs, you know, most people that are listening to this, they don't have a Peter Attia, and these doctors can be very expensive. How did you go about this before Peter?
I did. So I did this in Russia, where you can just show up at the lab and say, okay, here's, you know, $500 and here's all the tests that I want. I don't have a doctor's prescription. I'm prescribing those to myself. Go do it.
Yeah, I did this before Peter as well. And I used a company here in San Francisco. And I know this doesn't work everywhere because I know places like New York do not allow this. But there's a service called Wellness FX, just wellnessfx.com. And you can order blood tests, like pretty comprehensive blood tests on your own. And it takes a second. You print out the thing, you go into the lab, and then they will give you back actually a pretty beautiful UI back on the mobile app that shows you all of your blood work over time. And if they see anything that is a little bit alarming, they actually connect you directly with a doctor before they present you back your results. But yeah, 100%, not even 100%, like 1,000% recommend you work with a physician, because a lot of this stuff, you know,
it's hard to interpret. That's the challenge, because the labs, they have their lab ranges, but those are based on sick people. Those are not, you know, healthy people like, you know, Kevin or I. We usually don't show up to do a ton of blood work.
Right. Right. That's right. So you can imagine those ranges are, yeah, people are... They can be all over the place. So the things you were trying to fix, you were getting back to that, your bugs that you found.
Yeah. So we can talk. I think what would be interesting to do is to just talk through the compounds that some of the compounds I take.
And why, yeah.
And why. So I take metformin, which is a drug for diabetics. It's very safe. The only issue is if you have kidney problems. And what it does is it constantly lowers your blood glucose further. And the FDA right now is even running the first drug trial that has described aging as a disease. And metformin is the compound that people are using to try to combat aging.
Yeah, metformin is a amazing drug. Like the one thing that I don't take it because my glucose levels are pretty low to begin with, but my sister does. And one of the things that was really interesting about the study that they did is so diabetics take this, right? And they gave it to all these diabetics, and they found out that the people that were taking metformin were not only having obviously just like lower glucose levels, but were also dying less of cancers, which was just crazy.
Right. So that's metformin. Aside from that, so I take, as I mentioned, I take synthetic thyroid hormones, T3 and T4.
Right.
And the purpose is to get more energy and a better mood.
And that's something you obviously have to work with the doctor. Both those compounds, you work with the doctor.
Right. Especially hormones, because hormones, I mean, metformin is relatively straightforward. So for example, in Russia, it's just OTC. You can walk into the pharmacy and buy however much.
Wow.
But hormones are complicated systems, and you know, you really do want to work with someone giving you professional advice. Like, I wouldn't dare do the hormone stuff without Peter's help.
Yeah.
So the other thing I do on hormones is I take Clomid, which is a med that essentially, in my particular case, boosts testosterone quite significantly. So without going too much into details, it works as a signaling thing which tells my body to produce more testosterone rather than taking it exogenously. When I started taking it, my free testosterone rose by about 80%.
Yeah, so I tried Clomid as well, and it also freed up my testosterone. I was producing enough, but not enough free. There's bound and free. And I didn't, you know, for me, I didn't notice any energy difference. I didn't notice any mood difference. And so I ended up stopping taking it. But
yeah, I've definitely noticed it. I also take a couple other things. Arimidex and Dutasteride, which are two other things that kind of optimize, reduce conversion of testosterone to DHT and reduce conversion of testosterone to estrogen.
Right.
And that's all basically designed towards creating the optimal testosterone loop. And it's funny, I started seeing like my, I mean, I didn't really have thinning hair, maybe like on the edges, but I started seeing that like regrow very actively, which is pretty cool. And it was like very noticeable.
Yeah.
So that's the testosterone system. Then I take modafinil. Modafinil is a drug that a lot of people use and is an intelligence enhancer. And it seems... So I stopped doing Adderall because it was making me anxious. And modafinil is nice because there's been a number of meta reviews of modafinil in healthy people, and the conclusion was that it improves cognition in healthy people without any meaningful side effects.
One question about this, I have tried this one time because it was prescribed for me for jet lag, and it worked quite well for that. I was going to Japan one time. It just helps you kind of get to that stage of sleep and reset you a little bit. But my question is this something that you take this every single day?
Yeah.
And do you see it as something where I always worry about all these different nootropics and compounds that in my mind, there are things that are going and kind of like optimizing and potentially repairing and doing like positive things. And then there's this like, is this like nitrous just like going in, like ramping up the engine to go extra fast and causing more burnout? You see what I'm saying?
Like, yeah, I see what you're saying. I think that it's important to just make an aside as to what, you know, my objectives are and why I'm doing all of this. I do not have an objective to live 10% longer. My objective is to become extremely successful for the purpose of building one of the platform companies that are going to enable the singularity. So my dream is to 50 years from now, not even be a human anymore, be, you know, merged with artificial intelligence and data centers, post-human, super god. So
have you talked to Elon about this at all?
I have not, no. But I share his concerns about artificial intelligence in general. It's just that I don't want artificial intelligence to be something that takes us over, but I want to become part of whatever is going to be the next stage of human.
So you want to join the machines that overthrow humans?
I want to join the next stage of human evolution. I think that, you know, this is a longer conversation, but I think that we're kind of at a point where we can design ourselves to be much better and design ourselves to the point where we can explore the universe, solve extremely complex problems that we're facing, govern ourselves better as a society. And that requires giving up a lot of our animal origins and a lot of our kind of base instincts.
Or optimizing them,
right.
It could be that these animal origins are a lot more efficient at doing certain things. And
possible. I think it's like we're going to go down this rabbit hole for like an hour if we go at this. But
all right, so let's keep going down the list.
I think my point is just that I'm optimizing for performance,
okay,
not for, you know, 10% better longevity, because I don't care about that. I want to live for millions of years and be super intelligent, live, you know, 125 rather than 120.
That's what's interesting, because you're making a trade-off here, of course, in that some people believe the singularity and this idea of living forever is going to come later, and other people believe that this is the next 25, 30 years kind of window. So you're betting in my lifetime, in the next, let's just say, 60 years, like without... That's going to happen within the next 60 years, is basically what
you're saying. So here's my math on this. I'm 32. Today, people who are relatively well-off in well-off countries, actually the top quintile, top 5% of men in the United States already have a life expectancy of about 93 years old on average, without all the biohacking, without all the coming modern technologies. And if we look at most developed countries, we're still seeing a gain of about 2.5 years per decade of life just with the current trajectory of medical technology. So that by itself, without biohacking and without crazy nanorobots, genetic engineering, gene therapy stuff, that already gives me a life expectancy of around 110 years. And, 110 years from my birth, it's going to be 2095.
Yeah, so, but my problem is like modafinil, let's just say that it turns out that's actually doing more damage and we learn about that in 10 years. Now you kind of screwed yourself.
Well, so here's the thing. I mean, first of all, modafinil has been around for 25, 30 years and they haven't seen any negative effects quite yet. But secondly, it's a trade-off. I'm betting on that having superior focus and intelligence also enables me to be more disciplined, let's say, about my dietary habits or about my health in general.
Interesting.
So there's a lot of downstream effects from being smarter on health as well. So it's possible that modafinil has a negative if first order effect of some kind, but it enables me to do this deep work where I can figure out, hey, here are all the things I can do to make my health better.
You may not have had the focus to figure out the sleep equation had you not had the modafinil.
That's an example.
Which is going to lead to potentially preventing Alzheimer's because you're getting better sleep.
Yeah, that's a great
random example. But
so
yeah.
It feels to me like, in general, it's really important to focus on your ability to be productive and on your ability to do things like resist stress. So on that note, so I take lithium about 100 milligrams per day.
That's pretty high.
So people who take lithium for bipolar, people take about 2,000 milligrams, maybe 1,500, quite a lot.
Yeah, but they're not taking, you're probably taking Orotate.
Yeah, so carbonate.
Carbonate. Oh, so you're taking the same stuff that they prescribe?
Yes.
Okay.
I take the same stuff that they prescribe, and I basically take about 15 times less than someone who is bipolar. And I take about 20 times more or 20 to 30 times more than someone is getting just from water. There's actually a lot of evidence that lithium kind of helps your emotional control, plus that it's neuroprotective and has a host of interesting stuff.
That's why I drink this water. Do you know?
Okay.
Do you know this water?
I do not.
So this is the Gerolsteiner. It's a German water that
high in lithium.
Yeah. So here's the deal. So if you look at the back of it here, I got this at Whole Foods. They break down the calcium, magnesium, all that good stuff, right? And they say other minerals, and then it's 55 milligrams a liter. So I went on their website and looked it up, and this is actually, they have the exact microdose in one bottle of lithium in the naturally occurring lithium.
Very cool.
In this one thing of water. So I'll have one or two of these a day.
The psychotherapist I work with, and Peter, their opinion was basically like that 5 milligrams per day is not going to do anything. And then
there's those studies though that showed that even microdosing lithium out of groundwater prevents suicide.
Yeah, I've seen those as well.
Yeah,
I've seen those as well. So anyway, and that was like a barely noticeable effect in terms of emotional regulation. That's became better. I take escitalopram, which is called Lexapro as well, which is an SSRI antidepressant, and I take 10 milligrams a day, which is like a fairly standard dose, and that stuff is pretty wonderful. So that fixed, immediately was a slight elevation in my mood, but even better, it was just like constantly slightly elevated. And I never had bad mood days anymore. And that's, so if you think about that, like maybe that has some negative health effects somewhere if you take it for 50 years, but it reduces my stress on a daily basis, and stress is well known to be tied to many very, very bad things. And it enables me to, again, focus and do stuff for my health, for my career, and even it makes me more persuasive because as people, we really like others who are calm, relaxed, confident, etc. So,
yeah,
great deal.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's kind of all. Is that everything that you would say that falls into the bucket of mood, and or are there other compounds?
I think that's it on the mood. I'm just trying to think what else I take that would be interesting to describe from the kind of medically prescribed stuff.
How about the supplements, though? The supplements, I think, sure. is going to be really interesting to a lot of our viewers because they that you can just pick up at the
grocery store. Yeah, sure. So I can list them. I mean, it's going to be really long to talk through all of them.
Let's just hear some of them.
I take vitamin D to optimize to a certain level, which I think everyone should.
What do you aim for, about 40?
A little higher. So I aim for like 50 to 60 nanograms per deciliter. Whatever.
Yeah.
I take, I think, 5,000 IUs of vitamin D per day.
And do you do a K2 with that as well?
I do, yes.
Okay.
So then I take a very complex multivitamin called Life Extension Mix, which is probably the best multivitamin from what I've seen on the market. It's just easier to, it's just like has a lot of stuff packed into it.
Yeah, I haven't seen that one. I know the whole brand Life Extension, but I've never seen that particular.
Check it out. It's like basically the list of, the description list is like a page in a book.
What do you like about that one? Because I've been.
That it has a lot of the right stuff. So essentially you start realizing that, for example, you don't want to have folic acid in your vitamins. You want to have methylfolate.
Right.
Or you don't want to have, you want specific formulations of a number of compounds. And that one seems to have been well thought out. Yeah. That's really it.
That's right. That's the same for me. When I'm looking at my multis, I'm always looking for, one, the majority of the stuff should be non-synthetic. I don't want to have synthetic vitamins. And the other part of it is trying to find the methylated vitamins in there. Also, I look for ones that now have K2 bundled in to the multi.
So in terms of other supplements, there's stuff like magnesium threonate, there's Bacopa.
Bacopa is interesting.
Yeah, it is. There's some good data that shows that it improves memory.
Yeah.
And it lowers anxiety a little bit.
Oh my God, dude. So the first time I took Bacopa, I was like, I was just at home and I was like, oh, the memory. So I've always had issues with remembering names and faces and I'm horrible at that. And sometimes it's brutal here in the Bay Area because I run into a lot of entrepreneurs and I'll literally go to a coffee and have someone walk up to me and be like, ooh, I kind of know who that is, but I don't remember their name. And I'm just like, I'm great with spatial stuff. I'm horrible with short-term memory. Anyway, long story short, I was like, oh, I'm going to try this Bacopa stuff. Dude, I took it one night, just like a pill of it, and was kind of just like hanging out, wasn't drinking, wasn't doing anything. It was like I had like two glasses of champagne. Like I got this like nice little chill me out, like sink into the couch a little bit. Did you notice any like anti-anxiety stuff?
I did not, but so my philosophy with supplements has really been, I take stuff that's very unlikely to be harmful, mm-hmm. right? That's, you know, like green tea extract or something. You know that that's not going to cause problems for you if it's high quality manufactured. And that could potentially have some benefits. But I take, I think like 30 or 40 different pills. And I never really bothered separating them. I'm also like, okay, this is generally regarded as safe. I'm just going to take everything that might have some kind of effect. And half of it is useless or just placebo. Well, you know, that's okay.
That's so crazy. Like you and I do that a little bit differently. I'm a little bit more methodical about layering in things and then throwing away anything that I don't think works.
So I do that with proper prescription drugs for sure, okay. Because those are clearly powerful. But with supplements, I was like, okay, this is food. You know, I'm just trying to make sure that in addition to my natural high quality food, I also get this stuff.
Right,
you know?
Just fill the gaps. Yeah.
Right.
Okay. So what else? Do you do like a turmeric related thing? What about anti-inflammatory? Anything on that front?
Yeah, I take turmeric. I mean, it has so many different supposedly benefits that, you know, I don't even know how to describe it, whether it's anti-inflammatory or anti-cancer or whatever else. So yeah, I take that.
Any other ones that you think are worth touching on, or is that the...
Not, I mean, there's like fish oil, omega-3,
sure.
stuff like that, but not off the top of my head. I think that those are the most important ones. And you can see, like, if you read my articles, you can see the whole list of everything that I take. So, yeah.
Yeah. I wanted to also, before we wrap things up real quick, because I thought that was interesting about your article, and I highly recommend people go and check out these couple articles that you've published. But on the terms of, like, how you... the benefits of sex and how you approach it, I think is really unique.
Sure. Totally.
So what is your thoughts on all of that? Cause you approached it from a very kind of like, what's the best way to put this? I feel like you're just like, you see it as an essential tool, at times versus a relationship type thing. Is that right? Or am I,
So here's the thing. I'm not in a relationship now. I was in a relationship that was really wonderful for 4 years, and I screwed it up because I really went deep into my work, and I didn't have good enough emotional intelligence at that time to maintain it. But it was like it set a really high standard for me in terms of relationships. So now I'm just like, I'm not running after relationships or after sex. But at the same time, I mean, I want to have sex. So it's like you have this built-in desire. If you don't satisfy it, then you start, you know, whatever, watching porn all the time or like thinking about it all the time, going to bars, swiping on Tinder. And that wastes a lot of time. And it wastes a lot of time and a lot of energy. I'm open to, you know, long-term relationships, but I'm going to be very selective about that, because that's a person who I spend a lot of time with who has a significant impact on me. So I don't want to pick someone for that just because I want to, you know, have sex. So that's not a very good decision process around long-term relationships. So for sex, I basically go just, I have... In Russia, there's a lot of really beautiful women, and there's actually services, like I have a messenger bot on my phone, which sends me like 30 or 40 different profiles of like proper international published models a day with like links to their Instagram profiles, videos, whatever, and you can pay with like electronic money to get introduced to them. And then,
so there's no, this is not an escort service.
It's not, but it is. So it's both. So ultimately, what's the definition of an escort service? People who professionally sleep with people for money all the time. It's not that. So these are kind of either students or models or whatever, receptionists or something else who are looking for well-off people who are going to give them gifts or rent them an apartment and stuff like that. So it's less, it's definitely commercial. So I have no illusions about it being true love or anything like that. But it's a way for me to get the type of girl who I really, really find attractive without spending any time or effort on this, so that I have more time to study, learn about nanotechnology, or, you know, write my articles or whatever else. So I take a very practical approach to this. You know, relationships are one thing and sex is another thing, and both of those things are important. I don't have a relationship right now, so I'm just going to solve this the way I would solve if I wanted to have a really nice dinner. I could cook it at home, or I can hire some Michelin chef to do it for me. So
that's a very unique take. I say that I have heard of this approach, and so many people are afraid to even talk about it. You know, people that have done this, that I know that have done this.
Oh, yeah. So I actually had a lot of people reaching out to me and saying, wow, you're so brave talking about this. Can I get the contacts of those messenger bots? So it's really funny. A surprising number of people, actually, especially well-off people. I mean, this is very expensive. So well-off people that can afford it do this. And I would never want to do something like this while cheating on, you know, my girlfriend or wife. But right now, you know, it lets me do cool stuff. It lets me, you know, have threesomes or foursomes or go to a swing club, or, you know, there's one drug, GHB, that makes sex really, really amazing. So if you ever even consider doing this, like, you want to be extremely careful, never combine it with alcohol, and be extremely careful with the dose. It's very dangerous if you don't do it right. I just get to do really cool stuff, with cool, interesting women, and I don't have to spend all my time dragging myself around bars, disrupting my sleep. So I'm not ready to sacrifice my sleep from 9 p.m. till 6 a.m.
Do you see this as a way you could eventually meet someone, though? Could it be through this?
No, probably not. So I don't think so, because it's always once any kind of relationship has been based on like a somewhat commercial financial basis, that makes it not interesting for me, at least, because it's always going to have that mind frame. And some of those girls I've actually seen for years, on and off. So I enjoy having a longer term relationship with them, but it's never going to be serious. And both parties expect that it's just when I'm in town kind of thing. And neither party kind of places expectations on someone else.
Do you have reasons, either longevity or health-wise, that you approach sex for a certain, there has been some studies around, obviously stress reduction and things like that, but do you have technical reasons for this as well?
A couple of things. One, I noticed that sex actually boosts my deep sleep. So there's a very noticeable effect.
So you actually quantify that on your Aura ring. That's crazy.
Yeah, I did. It's very noticeable. And I discussed this with, I think I discussed it with Peter, and there was some reasoning behind it to do with hormone production. Hmm. Another thing is that sex, there's a lot of evidence that sex boosts your neuroplasticity and neurogenesis, which is very important for your ability to study and to learn. And then there's just the de-stress effect. And then there's just the effect that if you go for a while without it, you start just being very antsy and being really thinking about it all the time. And it starts distracting you from high quality work. So it's a combination of this. I think that doing it this way boosts your effective intelligence because you are less distracted and you're more satisfied on that front. I mean, sex is a very fundamental, basic human need.
So I wanted to touch real quick on, I guess your second article, what was the title of the second article you just recently put out?
How to Biohack Your Intelligence with Everything from Sex to Modafinil to MDMA.
Yeah, so on the biohacking the intelligence, and I guess diving a little bit deeper into memory and retention, how do you go about learning new information? What process, and do you repeat certain things? Do you have flashcards? What do you do when you want to learn something and retain it?
I don't think I have very good processes around that. What I try to make sure I do is get especially sleep. Sleep is very connected to retention, both sleep before learning and sleep after learning.
And I've heard exercise after learning is supposed to be.
There's a wonderful online class I recommend called Learning How to Learn.
Yeah, tell me about this, because you told me to sign up for it and I did, and I've yet to start the first course on it.
So it's the most popular online class in the world.
Where is this at? Is this you?
It's Coursera.
Coursera, that's right, Coursera.
It's a couple of neuroscientists, I don't remember the university, and they just talk through the research in a very chill, nice way. They talk through the research on memory and on retention. And a big part of what they're saying is that you need periods of focus intermixed with periods of rest and kind of what they call diffuse state, when you're not actively trying to learn something or focus on something, but you're just, I don't know, having a walk or meditating, and then ideas just pop into your mind. And I don't know about your experience, but that's certainly my experience, that a lot of ideas pop into my mind when I'm not working at all.
100%.
So my philosophy around learning is really that you want to make sure you have a lot of deep work time where you're completely undisturbed. And let's actually talk about this for a couple minutes, because in my article, one of the key things I focus on is that you want to turn off all notifications Get off social networks as much as you can. So I've actually set up VPNs that ban me from social networks. I've set up deleted social network apps from my iPhone. I moved all the messengers and Safari off of my home screen so that on my home screen, all I have are things I want to push myself to use, like Kindle or Audible or Overcast, so I can listen to more of Kevin's podcast.
You have the most, well, thank you for that. You have the most simplified home screen I've ever seen. Like you it's just, tell people about your wallpaper on your home screen.
It just says focus.
That's it. And you have like four icons or whatever.
Yeah, basically. So that thing definitely controls your mind to a significant extent. You interact with it so much. So you want to put stuff there that will provoke you into behaviors that you'd like to promote in yourself. And for me, that's really reading and studying and listening to podcasts and stuff like that, rather than going and mindlessly browsing online. I think it's really important to get rid of the news and the news media in particular. So the fact is, like, none of you, or I mean, I'm pretty sure none of you, and certainly not me or Kevin, are going to be able to do anything about Trump or Kim Jong-un or Putin, you know? So why are people spending so much time worrying about what Kim Jong-un is going to do with his nuclear missile capabilities? You know, it's outside of our circle of concern. And because it's a threatening thing, which is being pushed at us by media that is very motivated.
That's why people are worried about it, is that they feel a threat, right?
Exactly. It's a threat, but it's deliberately engineered by the media to make us care about things that actually don't matter. So like Kim Jong-un doesn't matter to your life because you're not going to be able to do anything about it. Like, and my sense is that stuff, it has an impact on you as a person. And it makes you more negative, more threatened, more thinking about the world in just darker tones. And I'd rather not be that way. So I've made a conscious decision to ban the New York Times, BuzzFeed, all of that stuff is banned for me from all of my devices. And I just never read the news. If it's going to be something relevant to my business, someone will tell me about it. So, you know, I don't have to do anything about it.
Yeah, I've turned off all news push notifications to my phone. I give myself a window. So I'll be like, okay, my news time is after I'm done with work, and I'll open up a browser, open up one news site, and it'll just be like my quick little recap of the day. I should probably punt that even further down to, like, you know, checking in like a couple times a week. The problem for me, and the reason I want to be a little bit more involved, is that I feel that if decisions are being made that I'm not happy with, I would like to at least figure out a way socially to have my voice heard or try and step in. I don't know. It's just a really scary time right now.
I just feel like, you know, it's because it's outside of my control, I want to focus on things I enjoy, like science and technology and emotional communication with other people, things like that.
Yeah.
And everything that we interact with leaves an imprint on our minds. And I actually don't want to have that social conversation about Donald Trump with anyone, because that makes some of my neurons more orange, you know? Like, they just turn orange every time I hear about this guy.
I love that.
So essentially, like, we have a limited ability to memorize things, to think about things. And I just want to completely remove all the stuff that's not just useless, but harmful. And I think that politics and political news media are definitely falling into that category.
Yeah.
As well as social networks, for sure. Especially 100%. Since it's well known that they engineer themselves to be more addictive and to pull sucker time and energy, you know?
Yeah. So that's right. Well, we're going to have you back on the show at a later point to talk about your vision for the future and how you want to participate in that, because I know you do a bunch of existing AI work with your engineers and the developers and the projects that you're working on. Where can people find you online?
So the best thing to do if you want to message me something is to just send me a message through Facebook Messenger or to leave a comment on one of my articles. So on Facebook, I'm at facebook.com/SergeF. I don't go on the actual social network, but I do have the Messenger for communication. And by the way, I'm sorry if I don't respond to any of you. It's just I do get a lot of messages and it's really hard to focus while getting back to everyone. So just if I don't get back, don't take it personally, but do send a message and do check out the stuff I write about and let me know if you guys have any ideas or suggestions, et cetera.
Awesome. Well, I appreciate you coming on the show today, and especially the fact that so many people are paranoid about sharing their experiences in this realm. And it's refreshing. I like it because whether you agree with your take on sex or whatever it may be, you're being yourself, you're being honest, and that I can always respect. So thank you for sharing.
Thank you for having me, and thanks everyone for listening. I'm really, glad to share my take with you and hope that it's been helpful.
Awesome. Well, we'll talk soon. Thanks everybody for listening to that episode. And another friendly reminder, do not try this stuff at home. A lot of the stuff is illegal in certain countries, cities, states, and can definitely do harm to your body. But it is really fascinating, bleeding edge research done by one individual. Always talk to your doctor and never do this stuff without your doctor's permission. And last little quick reminder, pick up that book, Lying. It was really awesome. I enjoyed it by Sam Harris. It's the one that we recommended during the podcast. And you can do that at audible.com/Kevin Rose, and you'll get that free book and 30-day free trial. Or just text 500-500 right now from your mobile phone. Text Kevin Rose to 500-500, and that will get you all set up with the free book and 30-day trial. That is it. If you want to help us out, head on over to your favorite podcast provider and give us 5 stars. That would be a huge help and boost to our rankings inside of that system, whether it be iTunes or Google Play. And we'll see you next time. Thanks.